This is Focus 580, hour number two of our show. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about the American economy and trying to concentrate on one subject in particular, and that is manufacturing and what is happening with manufacturing in this country. And certainly one of the things that we know is that over the past few years, there has been quite a significant decline in manufacturing and manufacturing jobs in the United States. In fact, for example, between 2000 and 2003, the United States lost 16% of its manufacturing jobs. And in recent years, there has been some further decline. So this morning, in this part of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about why that has happened, what it's meant for the American economy, and also to raise the question, is it possible to recapture some of those jobs? And our guest for the program is Susan Helper. She is a professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University. That's in Cleveland. She is a research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research, and we'll be talking about this subject. And it is, I also want to mention that it's the subject of a lot of things that she has written, but one thing in particular you might take a look at is a paper that she wrote for the Economic Policy Institute's Agenda for Shared Prosperity, and that's titled Renewing U.S. Manufacturing. And if you go to the Economic Policy Institute's website, you can take a look at that and other sorts of writings on that subject and on economic subjects. Questions, of course, are welcome here. If you'd like to join in the conversation, ask a question, make comment, that's certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, certainly all you need to do to be involved in the conversation is pick up the telephone and call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And at any point here, we'll get you in. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief in their comments so that we can keep things moving along. But questions, comments are welcome. Professor Helper, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks very much for talking with us. Maybe, again, just to talk a little bit basically about what's happening with the manufacturing sector in the United States and why that really matters. Starting out, I guess, just with the basic question, like, well, how many manufacturing jobs have we lost in the United States, say, just over the past decade?
Well, between 2000 and 2003, just those 3 years, we lost 3 million manufacturing jobs and have continued to decline. The numbers continue to decline since then, although at a slower rate. So it's quite a, as you mentioned before, that's 15% of the total. So it's quite a large number.
And at the same time, we would want to make the point that manufacturing is still, even though that there has been this significant loss, and people talk a lot about changes in the economy and perhaps the move away from manufacturing as being important, that in fact manufacturing remains important to the U.S. economy.
Yeah, there's a number of statistics that you can look at. It's more than 15% of GDP, 10% of jobs, and these jobs pay about 20% more than the national average. And it's about more than half of our national spending on research and development comes from manufacturing. That said, I think that, you know, there's a mix of good jobs and bad jobs in manufacturing. What I think is important about manufacturing is that it's a source of many good jobs, and policy should promote retaining good jobs in both manufacturing and in other areas of the economy as well.
Mm-hmm. And I guess important, though, to make this note that, in fact, we part of the concern is that some of the manufacturing jobs that we have lost, or the ones that we still have, are in fact good jobs. They pay a significant wage, and that's something that we would like to do what we can to hold on to it, at the very least, stop any further loss.
Definitely. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think we've had an idea that people ought to, who work hard, ought to be able to support their family, send their kids to college, etc. And for a number of years, we've had that dream, and particularly in unionized manufacturing jobs, that's been quite a feasible dream, and it's slipping away for many Americans.
Mm-hmm. Well, and another point I think is important, and I think that you've made in some of your writing, you want to make sure that people understand that that what has happened, there wasn't any sort of inevitability about it. I think that some people, again, when they talk about shifts in the economy and where the base of the economy is, they make it sound as if that's just something that was bound to happen and that we really can't do anything about it. And I think your point is, well, no, this really wasn't inevitable. And not only is it not inevitable, it's not irreversible.
Right. And there's a number of, I think, misconceptions about manufacturing. So just to take a couple of them, one is that you know, we couldn't possibly compete with the low labor cost of the Chinese. And a colleague of mine, Dan Luria, at the Michigan Manufacturing Technology Center, has collected some data on this among small firms and really estimated that on average, the cost differential between a U.S. company and a Chinese company might be 20%. And obviously, it's going to be different in different industries and for different firms, but that's not insurmountable. And it doesn't take into account various advantages that are harder to measure that this U.S. company might have, like the ability to deliver quickly, to respond quite quickly to a quality problem, to innovate and introduce new products, etc. So there's no kind of need to assume that because the Chinese pay a tenth of the wages that workers here receive and the working conditions are far worse, that we can't possibly compete.
Well, let's talk about what exactly happened and why, because I think that is the basic explanation that is often offered for the loss of manufacturing jobs. It is a simple sort of a straight line, and it has to do with lower wages and the fact that American manufacturers could say, well, I could continue to do this work here in the United States and I have to pay this much money to my workers, or we could shift this manufacturing overseas and we could send it to Latin America, we could send it to Asia, we could send it a lot of other places, and the wages that I would pay the workers are much less, and so that's good for my bottom line. I mean, is basically that the big thing that's resulted in the loss of American manufacturing jobs?
So I think there are three factors. So the one you mentioned is important, and that's partly driven by bad accounting systems. That our accounting systems that we use in companies cause people to do things that I would argue are not even profit maximizing, because the only thing they capture really well is the cost of direct labor. You know, that the person who actually touches the part that they're putting on the overall product. That's a very small part of total cost of manufacturing these days. It may be 5%. It may be 20%. So we know that when we go abroad, that the wage is going to fall. But what we don't know is what's going to happen to productivity, which generally falls. We don't know what's going to happen to various sorts of handoff costs, the need now to have communicate with people many thousands of miles away in a different culture. Unexpected things always happen in manufacturing, and solving these problems is a big part of what makes companies successful or not. That definitely gets more expensive when you get far away, and people don't really know how to measure those costs. They go into a variety of different budgets, et cetera. There's also ways to compete using the greater skill and education that we have in the U.S. that companies have not adopted, and they've adopted partly, again, because of this accounting reason that they don't look at these other costs and benefits. There's also and so let me describe what this new system is. It's often called high road production, and in it, it's a lot of it is sort of the Toyota production system, generalized to a variety of different products, and it involves highly trained workers and managers that work together to debug products quickly, to make suggestions, to improve how things are made, etc., and can lead to dramatically higher productivity, dramatically higher levels of quality, fast new product introduction, etc. And companies haven't wanted to adopt that, partly because they have the ability and the you know, what appears to be this attractive alternative to go abroad and find workers that don't complain, etc. Partly also because we as a nation haven't helped with those. There's some certain costs that are higher for firms, but and benefits that are shared more broadly in society that we could actually as a nation be better off if we helped firms to learn how to work in this new way and subsidize some of the cost of training, subsidize some of the cost of learning how to work in this new way, and we'd all end up better off.
Mm-hmm. So again, here, you see, your bottom line is that you're saying that by looking at your total cost of production, not just wages, that you can make an argument to American business, American manufacturers, that it's possible for you to stay in the United States and still make a profit, and that you're being a little short-sighted if the only thing that you do is look at your wage costs and make that the reason that you're going to go someplace else.
That's correct. And so for many firms, they're actually, you know, shortchanging their shareholders by going abroad because they don't fully understand their costs. There's other firms that are maybe benefiting their shareholders by going abroad, but they're hurting society. And so if we could, as the saying goes, pave the high road and block off the low road so that that companies didn't find it profitable to kind of inflict costs on society, then those companies also would find it profitable to stay here. And those kinds of things would be, you know, paving the high road is things that lower the cost for those firms of adopting these more socially efficient production processes, like a better education system, like the Manufacturing Extension Program, which helps firms to figure out how to do just-in-time production, how to introduce and develop new products. That would be sort of paving the high road. And then blocking the low road are things like trade agreements, putting labor rights and environmental rights in trade agreements so that firms can't profit by exploiting workers in other countries, and requiring firms to contribute to or somehow solving the healthcare problem. Would also dramatically lower costs for manufacturers in competition with other nations.
We have a caller here I want to bring in, and for anybody who might have just tuned in here in the last 5 or 10 minutes, I want to again introduce our guest, Susan Helper. She's professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and we're talking about the issue of manufacturing in the American economy and the loss of manufacturing jobs, something about why that's happened, and her argument that it's not only possible to stop that erosion, but perhaps to recapture some of these jobs. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes, David. Great program. My question is more of a, we all know that shipping jobs overseas to China and such has an employment impact, and a huge one at that. But I think one of the things that seems to get lost in the mix is the environmental impact of shipping jobs to, say, China, that doesn't have hardly any environmental regulations. And if I may, one more question. Does the guest think that maybe if we had, say, a universal health care, which would put us at a more competitive advantage with other countries, that would that help, you know, bring jobs back into the United States and manufacture things in a little more environmentally responsible way? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay, well, you can respond however you like.
Great. No, those are both, I think, very good and important questions. that, so first on the environmental stuff, there are some ways in which the Chinese production process actually comes back to hurt us. I mean, there's a significant part of Chinese contribution to global warming that is because they're making products for us and making them in less energy efficient ways than we would make them here. So there's a, and then there's also the impact of Chinese production on the Chinese people. I mean, often it's sort of said that people who want revisions in trade agreements somehow don't care about Chinese workers. And I think that the advantage of this idea that we want to put labor rights and environmental rights in the trade agreements is it says, no, we actually want, you know, workers in both the U.S. and these other countries to be better off, to have the opportunity to have good jobs at good wages and live in a sustainable society. On the second question about health care, yes, it's a major problem. The auto companies were saying they spent, you know, about $1,000 a car on workers' health care, which is, you know, way more than they spend on the steel. And Toyota recently put a plant in Canada rather than the U.S., in part because the costs were lower because of the national health care system. So I think both the caller's points are excellent.
Are there now American companies, manufacturers, who have sent jobs overseas starting to rethink this and starting to ask this question, is it possible for us to bring some of these jobs back and not do it just sort of for the sake of doing it, but do it for the sake of the bottom line?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of cases where firms have gone abroad and found that it, you know, just didn't work, that they didn't get the productivity they were going to get. I mean, there's whole industries that have come back. I mean, things are so dynamic, it's sort of hard, but for a while there was a lot of electronics assembly done in Mexico, and now there's a lot of that is done with automatic insertion equipment that doesn't really matter where it gets done in terms of the labor cost, and there's some advantages to doing it in the U.S. But I think that, and to some extent, we've seen with the fall in the U.S. dollar that some work has started to come back.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think that could happen. One of the things that has to happen relatively quickly, though, is that the tide has to be turned because we're starting to lose capabilities here. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal last week about a company, a guy who wanted to make shoes in the U.S., and actually in terms of what he did, his own factory was cost competitive, but he couldn't get the parts that he needed, or, you know, the components to make the shoe because all the suppliers had relocated to China or Brazil, or et cetera. So right now, these kind of agglomeration economies, the advantages of having a lot of different kinds of production all together, still in many industries, shoes accepted, still weigh in favor of staying in the U.S., but that's beginning to change as more and more of the work moves abroad. And so I think this kind of jump-starting needs to happen soon. So I guess in answer to your question, we're seeing a tiny bit of trickling back. We're definitely seeing a slowing of the rate of movement away, and we could, through good policy, accentuate both those trends.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll talk. Well, lines are filling up now here. Let's talk next with someone in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. When the free trade agreements were negotiated, I believe there was a total lack of workers' rights and fair wages, which would have helped our domestic workforce simply because the disparity in wages wouldn't have been so great. Who do we lay the blame on that, to Clinton and Bush Jr. or simply Bush?
Well, I think there's probably lots of blame to go around. I mean, the treaty was actually passed in 1993 when Bill Clinton was president. So he probably could get some of the blame, I guess, for that. there was also a very strong lobbying to leave that out. There is actually in NAFTA a side agreement on labor and environmental rights, but it's a totally toothless tribunal. The worst thing that can happen to a company that's accused of violating labor rights is they can be called in for a ministerial consultation, or the government of the country, of the company, can be called in for a ministerial consultation. So there's really no teeth to it. And I think there's a variety of kind of failures of will that cause that agreement to be negotiated that way.
Aren't the free trade agreements a lot more extensive in the Bush presidency than they were in Clinton, although Clinton may have initiate them?
Yeah, they certainly, and there is apparently a free trade agreement with Jordan that has pretty good labor rights provisions. Now, our trade with Jordan is not immense. And I guess there's the Chinese entry into WTO was 2000 or 2001. So I guess I'm not actually sure who was president, but it's certainly clear that President Bush has not, shall we say, been leading the way on adding these labor rights or environmental rights provisions to trade agreements.
Thank you.
All right. Let's just for a second stay with NAFTA, because it has been recently a subject of discussion in the competition between Senators Clinton and Obama, particularly when they were in that run-up period to the primary in Ohio. And some people have been very critical of the North American Free Trade Agreement and said that it facilitated and accelerated job loss. Do you think, in fact, that that was the case?
Yeah, I would agree that I think it has. There have been, in some cases, exports that have increased, for example, corn, but that hasn't offset the job loss. I think that the impact of NAFTA is actually to be measured not just in job loss, but in something that actually Barack Obama referred to, which is the change in bargaining power, that the extent you make corporations more mobile, they have more bargaining power, and then workers on both sides of the border who are less mobile lose out. And so we see on both sides of the border less wage growth than we might see otherwise. And particularly in the U.S., I think less willingness to invest in the kind of skill development that I was talking about that would lead to new introduction, new products, just-in-time delivery and production systems, et cetera, the kinds of things that are really needed to compete in this global economy.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Joliet, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I disagree with some of this stuff. I'll tell you why. I'm in the service industry, and I've seen a lot of these people get hit big time. And it's solely, to me, what I can see from my end of the spectrum, is that it's the cost of the workers, the cost of retirement benefits, because there's the bulk of the baby boomers will be retiring in the next few years. They're worried about that. Companies are not even in competitive anymore with any foreign labor market, because they could do it cheaper, not so much faster or quality-wise. It's just the cheaper version of it. And that's what the big problem is. We cannot compete with slave labor, because that's what it's coming down to. You know, when you got companies like Motorola and you know, some tractor manufacturers trying to compete with Caterpillar, like I forget the name of it, but you know, it's impossible. The other spectrum, though, is the auto manufacturers, which, of course, you know, Toyota and Nissan and so forth, they're building cars over here, so kind of offset that. But we do have a lack of knowledge of the NAFTA thing, and you can't put it all on Bush or Clinton. It's a full package between the last 30 years, basically the Congress and the Senate selling out America for cheaper labor.
Well, Professor Helper, you want to comment on that, or can you comment on that?
I mean, I think I can agree with the caller. It sounds like the caller and I agree that maybe the point of an economy ought to be to produce high wages and, you know, and good jobs for its members, for its citizens. And that would apply not only to the U.S. economy, but to the Mexican economy, the Chinese economy. And that policies that have been implemented over the last 30 years have not seemed to have had that goal. The policies seem to have been, allow multinationals to pick and choose the kind of labor force that they want, and to reduce the bargaining power of workers and their ability to achieve the good jobs and the ability to compete on the basis of productivity and new products, et cetera, rather than on the basis of, you know, who's willing to exploit themselves the most.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is Belgium, the community that's nearby here. Line number two. Hello.
Yes, a couple of quick points. First, not a question, but I'd like to point out that it is NAFTA, which is North America Free Trade Act, which really North America, the business we do with Canada and Mexico is really not the true problem. The true problem is all the business that's going to China and Southeast Asia. That most of our jobs have gone that way. But that's just a sideline. The real thing I wanted to point out is the fact that we all search for cheaper prices. And I've mentioned this before on Mr. Inge's thing. And if now not only do we as individuals always look to go to Walmart to buy the Chinese product, but even our federal government now buys airplanes from France. We're sending every type of business we can possibly think of someplace else. Isn't it pretty much time we start getting a little bit more protectionist?
That's very interesting. It is interesting to me that it's become NAFTA that has been the focus of the campaign. I mean, it feels sort of like all of a sudden I'm in a time warp to 15 years ago, because I do think that the whole structure of the WTO, the World Trade Organization, is an issue. I guess the way I've been viewing the NAFTA debate is it's more symbolic. But I think it is important to remember that it is not just these two countries, Canada and Mexico. It's the structure of trade around the world that's causing these problems and this competition based on exploitation rather than on productivity. This issue about us, we all want to seek the cheapest price. I think there's a difference in what consumers do and what the government does. We think of the government as being, our best selves, and we come together to make collective decisions. The government can kind of set the rules. And it seems to me the government should structure competition in these more productive ways by, putting labor and environmental rights in trade agreements. So making it difficult for companies to compete in these ways that actually hurt society and directing competition toward things that actually help society. And, as an individual purchaser, you can't really do that. You can have a tiny impact, but these collective decisions are much more important in that area.
So wouldn't it be wise for our economy, even though we might have to pay a higher price for something that I build here in the United States compared to what might be made in India or whatever country we may want to choose, we are at least supporting ourselves. And it's something that we got to get back to, because if we don't pay ourselves, how can we afford to buy what we want to get from somebody else?
Well, there, I guess I would disagree a little bit. Like this tanker deal that the Air Force just signed. I'm not an expert in that area. I do think that there's some things that suggest that actually that worked well. That was a good process. So first of all, we think about why did the EADS Northrop Grumman coalition win? At least according to the Air Force, it wasn't because the wages in France or wherever were cheaper. So there wasn't, exploitation in that way. What the Air Force claims is that they got a better product and that Boeing was, in fact, acted like an arrogant monopolist. And so there it seems like we actually do see some of the benefits of trade as consumers. And I guess I would also point to the auto industry as an example of, or at least the competition from Toyota. I mean, it's really forced American cars to get much better. Quality levels have dramatically increased. The lifespan of a car is much longer. And I think that's because of the competition from companies like Toyota and Honda. So I think we have to balance, the benefits to consumers that come from trade and then, set rules to make sure that the competition happens in this fair way rather than in this kind of antisocial way.
thank you very much.
Thank you. We are just a little bit past our midpoint here, and I would just like to take the opportunity to introduce once again our guest, Susan Helper. She is professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and we're talking about manufacturing in the United States, its significance in the U.S. economy, the fact that we have lost manufacturing jobs, what that's meant, and what can be done to, at the very least, stop that loss of jobs and possibly to attract some jobs back, at the very least to hold on to the manufacturing jobs that we have. Again, questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And on again, we'll go to somebody in Champaign next, line three.
Thank you, Susan.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you.
You have a very broad topic here. I have several things that I'd like to talk about, and I'll try and keep it as brief as I can. First of all, the U.S. government, i.e. the DOD, you know, they're not really required to buy U.S. products. And this is almost stifling because, you know, in terms of consistent for small businesses, entrepreneurs, they don't really go in that direction. And the U.S. government's one of the few places where they consistently pay their bills. If you talk to some of the small businesses as they're trying to initially start out, that's a huge problem. And so whenever the U.S. government, if they're not even going to buy from our small vendors, it really puts a huge burden on them, especially if they're going to go outside the country. Again, small entrepreneurs, very tough. The other point that I want to make and is the trade policy that we're using is really a tool that they're trying to leverage our foreign policy interests. And this is becoming a huge factor. So the trade policies aren't necessarily as important as the foreign policy interest, and there's virtually nothing we can do about that. And I see that a lot across the world. Would you care to comment on that?
Let's see. On the first thing is sort of Buy American Act, and when should we do that? So I think there are these kind of competing goals here that we have, say, as a government. So one is that, to employ people, that suggests, you know, buying in the U.S. The other is to kind of get the best deal, and because we're also consumers and we want to, you know, government should be acting as a careful steward of the people's money. There's a bill called the Patriot Corporations Act, actually introduced by one of my senators, Sherrod Brown, and your two senators, Durbin and Obama, and the idea is that firms that actually act in ways that promote the social good, so they pay a fair wage, they're neutral on unionization, let workers choose if they want unions, they provide health care, a bunch of other things, would actually get a preference in government procurement. Not an absolute preference, because, again, we don't want to be paying vast amounts for these benefits, and they also get a small tax break. So I think that's a really good way of balancing these variety of these needs. You mentioned the foreign policy issues, and I think that one aspect of our foreign policy is our incredible need for oil, and that drives certainly a lot of our military policy and our military adventures. And need to spend, you know, $500 billion on I guess, non-Iraq military costs. And so one actual piece of the program that I lay out in the paper that was mentioned at the beginning of the show is a kind of renewable energy proposal. And what I show in the paper is that if we had a renewable energy capacity, develop renewable energy capacity that would be mostly solar and wind, to provide about 25% of our electricity demand, that would employ almost 1 million people, provide them jobs for 5 to 10 years at least, and that would be just the direct jobs, no multiplier, no nothing. So that would be a significant source of employment, and I think it would also go a long way toward removing some of these problems, I guess, that lead us to need to spend a lot of money on foreign oil and then on military capabilities to defend access to that oil.
Yeah, that seems like a logical choice. I have one other quick question here. You know, we have so many different issues going on, and one of the other things, too, is there's a technology multiplier. In other words, you know, we have robots in the manufacturing sector, so the, you know, the typical automobile plant, you know, in terms of the number of people that it would take to produce an automobile, the actual number of actual man hours has dropped significantly. There, in order to run a manufacturing plant, it just doesn't take as many people. This is something else that's being done, but yet we're still hearing some of the folks. Bill Gates said something today about, well, he can't find enough American computer guys, basically, so he needs more H-1A visas in order to let these guys come into the country. This is another problem, that instead of going to U.S. labor, they're willing to import them into the country to go ahead and actually accomplish these tasks. So there's a couple things there I'd like to comment on. I think it's time for me to hang up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think two very important points. So some people say that automation is, you know, the cause of this decline in U.S. manufacturing jobs. And that's not necessarily true. I mean, most of these are international markets. And if you thought that automation was really what was driving and productivity increase was what was driving the job loss, then you would think that the U.S. would be, you know, so super efficient that it's exporting around the world. So I think that while automation explains some of the job loss, these trade problems that exchange explain a lot as well. As far as the program is the H-1B visa, and I think this also fits with U.S. management's desire to basically have workers they can control. The advantage of people who come over on H-1B visa is that they are brought over by a specific employer and for, I think, 3 years. And if they should lose that job, then they're sent home. So they have way less rights than an American company. And so rather than, say, lobby for better training of computer programmers here or increasing the pay of computer programmers here, I mean, you know, inherently computer programming is not a bad job. It's the one in which wages have stagnated because they've been able to import so many people with worse alternatives from abroad. So I think this general point about let's try to see how we can make work better rather than import workers with few rights from abroad, I think that point holds.
Well, just another, this is maybe a slightly different question, but you were talking earlier about the fact that there we can maybe work on a couple of levels if what we want to do is strengthen American manufacturing, and that on the high road there are things that you can do for manufacturers to increase their efficiency, for example. I wonder whether you think that at least a part of this, if not a big part of this, is our failure to invest in human capital in the sense of what we're doing to produce a highly educated, able workforce, people who can do the jobs, and that one of the things that we're going to have to do if we want to strengthen manufacturing and hold on to jobs is to do something about the education system that we have.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's critically important. And so I guess my general view is that the way to save manufacturing is it's going to require a lot of interdependent programs, and as a byproduct, will not just save manufacturing, but make a lot of other industries more productive. We could, you know, solve our dependence on foreign oil, do a lot of different things all at once. And education, just for so many reasons, is a very critical thing, and you know, it's more difficult now, I think, in many ways, for parents to send their kids to college, and that's completely crazy because of the needs. Having said that, I guess I don't think that education alone, people say, oh, we don't need to worry about trade, we'll just send everybody to college and that will solve the problem. And I think that's not correct either, that the average, if you look at the earnings of the median college-educated man, they've gone up about 0.5% a year since 1973. So it's, you know, sending everybody to college is not a panacea that's going to solve our problems here. It's, you know, as we say in academia, it's a necessary but not a sufficient condition. And I think one of the additional things that we need in manufacturing is a program I referred to before called the Manufacturing Extension Program, which is this tiny program less than $100 million, and I'm proposing expanding it to $300 million, which is still less than a day of the Iraq War. And what that does is it teaches manufacturers how to use the skills that their workers have. So we train the worker, and then you can rearrange your production process to actually involve workers in, say, doing their own scheduling, in doing their own quality control. And so at plants that have been successful in doing this thing, like the there's a Mittal steel plant in Cleveland where there are basically no supervisors anymore because the workers have taken over this work because they're more educated. So the combination of increasing education then revising the production process, I think, is really a great one.
All right. We have a number of callers here, and we have about 8 or 9 minutes left, so we'll try to get in as many as we can. We'll go next to Urbana and line one.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi. I'm sort of wondering about this in terms of national security. California bridge was damaged a few years back, and I believe they just happened to have a new construction job going on, so they were able to replace the girder. If they had not, it would have taken 6 months to get it from China. And then with our whole electrical grid, I believe that's also something where some of the fundamental pieces would have to come from abroad. This seems to me like a crazy way to do business.
Well, can you comment on that?
Yeah, I think that's another very important point. I mean, it kind of goes along with this idea that there's a lot of things that we can do, that we should be doing anyway, that would also promote manufacturing. And so, I mean, the way I prefer to say it is the other way, that promoting manufacturing can help solve a number of really important national goals, and rebuilding infrastructure is a really important thing. So right now, the Society of Civil Engineers says that 27% of bridges are structurally deficient and need immediate attention. And so you're going to solve some problems, and you could provide about 47,000 jobs for each $1 billion you spend on infrastructure. Some of those would be manufacturing jobs, some of them would be construction jobs, but it's a great way of providing good work for people and leaving a lasting mark on our standard of living.
Hmm. But do you think it is a case, as the caller suggests, that there are examples where there are things that are very important to either our economy or possibly even to our defense that for which we depend on foreign suppliers, and that's problematic?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's true. There's examples in the military supply chain. I think small arms may be one of them, but there are a number of examples of things that we actually don't make anymore, and it does seem to be risky. We're a big country. I think we don't need to be self-sufficient in everything, that there are things that it makes sense for us to import, but it also is probably wise for us to maintain the capability to make a little bit of those things that are necessary for our national security.
All right. Next, we'll talk with someone in Posodum. This is line three. Hello. Is there a caller there, line three? Well, perhaps not. In any case, if you have questions for the guest this morning, our guest, and let me introduce her again, is Susan Helper. She's a professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University. That's in Cleveland. We're talking about manufacturing and the role that manufacturing plays in the American economy and what we can do to strengthen that. Questions are welcome. We have about 5 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. All right, let's try Champagne caller line number two. Hello.
Hi, yeah. Hi, yeah. Just two comments. Earlier, the gentleman was saying that buying American or even buying at higher prices might be a solution. And I really feel that the cost savings I'm a frugal person, the cost savings that are available to me are then just put back in the economy via investing, either through a mutual fund or even maybe some speculating went online. I hardly would ever invest in anything other than an American company just because of the stability factor. So I don't always feel that shopping at Walmart is necessarily a bad thing. The other thing is with education. I feel like a lot of times with a bachelor's degree, I'm not gonna name them what discipline or whatnot, but kids will walk out of college at 22 without really acquiring very much in terms of a skill set. You know, I mean, they'll definitely enhance their ability to organize information, produce papers, and have an opinion about something. But in terms of hardcore skills that they can contribute to a company and its ability to be productive, there's a big gap there. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, why is there more of a push to view community colleges and trade schools as they're so valuable, and the skills they acquire there are so practical and useful and very difficult to replace overseas? I mean, we're not going to bring diesel mechanics over. Maybe we are. I mean, I'm speaking out of ignorance, but we're not going to bring diesel mechanics, I think, as high of a rate or a lot of these technical jobs overseas as often. And manufacturing, being jobs are very repetitious, and I really don't think give the worker enough credit in what they're probably capable of doing. Why isn't there more of a shift maybe towards more practical education as opposed to either academic or nothing at all? Those are my comments.
Okay. Professor Helper?
No, I think that's a great point, that there are a number of people who may not want to go to college, and the hands-on reasoning that and training that you get in a community college, or particularly an apprenticeship program, can be both very useful for them and very good for companies. And a lot of companies, because of the shrinkage in manufacturing, have kind of shut down their apprenticeship program. And now the pace of retirements is actually exceeding the pace of shrinkage. And so there are a number of very high-skilled jobs going begging, and we need to figure out how to restart our apprenticeship programs and pay more attention to community colleges, et cetera. And just, I think the level of subsidy for higher education in all needs to go up. But just a plug, four generations of my family actually has gone to the University of Illinois. My father grew up on a farm, and not only was he able to put himself through school, the University of Illinois in the 50s, he was able to send money back to the farm. I think that's, you know, impossible to imagine today, that he was, you know, kind of supporting his parents while paying his way through school. That just the kind of level of subsidy that we provided in the past, we're not providing now, and I think that's problematic.
Mm-hmm. I think the caller raises a really interesting point that while it is true that people say that to get a good job and to produce the kind of workers the economy needs, you really have to have post-secondary education. But I think also at the same time, people say that we really ought to have a greater range of post-secondary options to provide different kinds of education and different training for different people for different jobs, and not make it out to be that somehow one is better, one kind of thing is better than the other, or that a four-year degree is somehow superior. That person ends up being superior to the person who maybe has a two-year degree, or some other kind of training, like apprenticeship or a training in a particular kind of trade or craft.
No, I definitely agree with that. There's something called the Manufacturing Skills Standards Consortium, MSCC, that has developed a large number of sort of skills and certification programs, so that somebody who does get a certain amount of training in, you know, a company or puts together a number of certificate programs, they actually will have a portable skill that, you know, like a college degree, that you can, you know, I can go to any university, you know, I have a PhD from Harvard, and they'll, you know, kind of know what that is. And this is a similar effort to say this is a master mechanic or a millwright or something like that. So I think it's one piece of a very important effort to value, to both create and to value these skills, as you're suggesting.
Mm-hmm. One more caller, Chicago, line one. Hello.
Hi. Very briefly, our economy is predicated on the belief that it can only succeed if the population is ever increasing. Yet this is an impossible situation. We're presently overpopulated worldwide, and in the United States we have 300 million people. The experts tell us there are only resources to really support only about 125 to 150 million. Now, the ultimate answer to that is reduction in population, which means birth control. And this is being entirely ignored.
Well, I'm going to have to jump in because we're really short on time. And this is a little bit off our topic. I don't know if it's something that you can make some kind of comment on.
Well, I think one thing that is clear is that we're all going to need to reduce our resource use. And one way to do that is to have fewer people. Another way is to become more efficient. And so I think moving into renewable energy, doing things to increase energy efficiency, both in our homes and our manufacturing plants, all contribute to the goal of reduced resource use.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we're just here at the end, having skated over a very complicated topic. Perhaps there are some of these threads we can come back and pick up on future programs. But we want to say thanks to our guest, Susan Helper. She's professor of economics at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, research associate of the National Bureau of Economic Research. And also, if you're interested in this subject, you might go to the website of the Economic Policy Institute and look at their agenda for shared prosperity and look at a paper that she wrote for them titled Renewing U.S. Manufacturing, looking in some greater detail at what we've been talking about here this morning. And Professor Helper, thank you very much.
Thank you. Great questions.
Focus 580, our program made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers four area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. I just want to remind you that tomorrow morning on the program, in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about heart disease, talking a little bit about causes, risk factors, and the current state of medicine in terms of treating heart disease. And our guest for the program will be Dr. Martin Lipsky. He is the regional dean for the University of Illinois College of Medicine at Rockford. And then in the second hour, we'll talk about a couple of things that are definitely connected: funding for primary secondary education and poverty and inequality in the state. We'll have two guests, Elizabeth Powers, who is associate professor of economics at the U of I, and also Peter Mulhall. He is the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs Center for Prevention Research. All of that tomorrow morning here on Focus 580. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. And right now we want you to stay tuned, because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host is Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we will talk with historian James Percoco about his book, Summers with Lincoln, Looking for the Man in the Monuments. He'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat trading at $13.33, up 72. In Chicago, March wheat $12.19, down 21. May $12.95, up 72. July $12.43, up 61.25. March corn $5.59.75, down 4.25. May $5.69, down 3.5. July $5.81.5, down 3. December $5.82, down 3.5. March soybeans $13.88, down 4.5. May $14.01, down 6.75. July $14.20, down 3.5. And November $13.24, that up 8.75. March meal $3.45 even, down $2. March oil $62.60, up $1.40. May $62.95, down 24. April live cattle $90.47.5, that up 57.5. June $92.15, up 45. March feeder cattle $99.70, down a nickel. April $102.45, up 10. April lean hogs